We welcome you to session 255 at the 2010 Sunstone Salt Lake City Conference. The topic is Life After, The Journey from Active Mormon to Reflective Unitarian by Marvin Ryden. Be sure to turn off your cell phones because you'll need to know that we have a small trap door under each seat and there are some hungry lions down below in case you... We hated to lose a couple of people earlier in the conference, but that's a good lesson, though, for everybody. Mary Ellen emailed me about 3 weeks ago, said, could you chair a couple sessions? And why don't you send me, three or four, as you look through the program, three or four that you'd like to be good possibilities, and I'll pick one or two. And so when I saw Marvin writing on the program, Marvin Ridding. Good. There's a fellow Iupui professor. They both taught at Iupui in Indianapolis. When I saw his name, I said, "Well, I got to have that one because Marvin is really the reason I'm here." Because I started attending Mormon History Association meetings back in 1971, and they were very welcoming of RLDS historians. All of us historians of earliest church that did anything virtually were in the Mormon History Association. But by the early 80s or so, I thought, MHA is getting a little bit, well, at least it's a little bit narrow. And I was being told, yeah, I've got to go to Sunstone. You'll enjoy Sunstone. Russell, the kind of guy you are, you'll enjoy Sunstone more. And that was very good advice. So I finally came in 84. And when I heard Marvin's paper, and the one thing that struck me that I remember forever, I quoted it in my book, Homosexual Saints, the Community of Christ Experience, a couple years ago, was in his paper, Marvin said, we as a church, we value love and commitment and, monogamous relationships and so forth. If that's the case, then why does the church withhold its support and its respect if it happens to be of the same sex? I thought, wow, this Sunstone is a pretty cool place. And there's a lot of other sessions that similarly were very interesting, but that's the one that really stuck in my mind. Marvin taught psychology and was an administrator at Indiana University, Purdue University, at Indianapolis. Iupui is the proper name. He's a colleague there with Jan Shipps. He's been a Sunstone columnist and a presenter at previous Sunstone. So welcome, Marvin, to our session today.
I'm actually here in the role of historic relic because I'm the exhibit from the first decade. And the irony of the paper in 1984 that Bill referred to, that got him started in Sunstone, that was the paper that ended my Sunstone time. It was the last time that I was here. I did come the following year in 85 to give a response, but that was the last paper I gave.
You got excommunicated too, didn't you, for that?
Yeah, that's part of the story. We'll get to that part.
Okay.
But it was an eventful paper.
Okay.
For both of us.
Yeah.
I'm in that old timer camp, coming back to celebrate, and so as an old timer, I'm going to tell a few stories. The good news is you haven't heard them 17 times yet, and you don't have to listen to them another 17 times like my grandchildren will. So I hope they'll be okay. Just want to start with a few memories. I have a vivid memory of watching the movie Galileo in 1975, and I found myself tightly clutching the arms of the theater chair during the part where Galileo recants in response to the Inquisition. A voice inside of me was crying, no, don't. What surprised me was the strength of my reaction. I didn't understand why that struck me so hard. I didn't realize that it would later come to be personally relevant to me. A few years later, I was trying to explain to a colleague why I stayed in the Mormon Church when I was obviously at odds with the Church on many social issues. She had referred to me as a walking contradiction. And I replied that being a Mormon was more than simply a religious belief. It was congenital in a kind of a tribal or a cultural way. I could not be Mormon than a Jew could not be Jewish. I added, though, that if for some reason I were to leave the Mormon Church, the only other thing I could possibly be would be a Unitarian, since Mormonism had ruined me for any Orthodox Christianity. I had spent my youth as a good Mormon boy. I remember being envied by kings, and then I was an adolescent spiritual giant. BYU was the only college I even considered applying to. I looked forward to reaching new heights of spirituality and my mission. Seeds of change were planted at BYU, however, and they started growing during my mission. I still have a visual image of the bulletin board in the J. Reuben Clark Jr. Library outside the honors reading room, and it had a poster with a blue cover of the first issue of Dialogue, a Journal of Mormon Thought, and I was struck and captured it. It was an amazing idea, thinking and talking about Mormon topics. Even though I was a poor, struggling student with no disposable income, I managed to find a way to subscribe, and my parents, without having a clue of what it was, kept my subscription going during my mission. So I was a long-time Dialogue person. The missionary work didn't come naturally for me. I was never comfortable with proselyting. I enjoyed teaching and working with the members, and I enjoyed the mission home work. But the mission itself was not the spiritual feast that I had anticipated. Perhaps it was the basic business-like sales model that was popular at the time was not conducive to spirituality for me. Or maybe I was just discovering that I really wasn't a spiritual giant after all. I mean, the spiritual giant missionaries were out encountering and casting out evil spirits all the time. I never encountered an evil spirit, even in Brazil. I heard the stories about how you're supposed to do this, but I never had the experience. It occurred to me that maybe Satan knew that I was really a skeptic at heart, and so he was keeping the evil spirits, his horde of spirits, away from me so that I would come to doubt their existence. What a clever little devil he was. In truth, I'm not sure that I ever really had spiritual experiences. They may have been only cognitive experiences with spiritual topics. I knew how to perform religiously, but I suspect that my outward spirituality was more a reflection of a competent performance of cultural expectations than a true spiritual expression. I studied and knew the gospel forwards and backwards, even the parts that I wasn't supposed to study and know. I admit a fondness for the mysteries. I could give impressive and inspiring talks in church, and my prayers were solemn and touching, but I think the unifying theme was always competence. Even my temple devotion was mainly driven by the desire to be competent. I became a bell worker at 19, even before my mission, because I wanted to be competent. But I was never really comfortable bearing my testimony. It always felt forced, and I avoided it as much as I could. I was not comfortable with blessings. I could do the anointing part with the rote phrases, but I did not feel spiritually in tune enough to confidently seal the blessing and say what was going to happen. And I think it was on my mission that I first suspected that spirituality was not really one of my core competencies. And then near the end of my mission in Brazil, I decided that missionary dress code ought to be to look like a well-dressed businessman, local businessman, or a local church leader. And so I grew a mustache. It was a great hit with the members because all of the local leaders, from branch president to mission in the mission presidency, had mustaches. But it proved to be a little bit of a shock when I arrived home. And adding to that a little bit of rebellion, I chose as the text of my welcome home address the opening lines of A Tale of Two Cities. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. That was not appreciated either. And my poor mother afterwards walked around in a haze, telling total strangers, he really is a good boy. He really is. My academic area was social psychology and personality theory. My deep interest in personality theory had been sparked and nurtured at BYU. I was immediately drawn to the humanistic theorists because they believed in the concept of free agency. behaviorism was deterministic, Freud was deterministic. The humanists believed in a free will. And so I gravitated for that reason. And being intrigued with humanistic personality theories naturally drew me into humanistic psychology in general, and humanism in more general, and feminism, which is part of that. And I got involved in a point of view that went beyond merely free agency, that valued things such as individuality, self-actualization. And even self-actualization sounded like it might be like eternal progression. It sounded like a Mormon concept. But I discovered that indeed the model for self-actualization was the opposite of the model of eternal progression. So, but I was drawn by my Mormonism to humanistic psychology. And then in social psychology, my interest area was in the area of intimacy and sexuality and marriage and family. I was drawn to that because they were stress points in Mormon culture, and I wanted to understand the stress points in Mormon culture. And so on both fronts in my academic work, the stage was set for me to become a walking contradiction, with my academic work increasingly at odds with my religious work. At first, I dealt with this dilemma privately. I created a matrix of church teachings, policies, and practices compared to the essence of the gospel through tangential policy down to cultural contamination, and I spelled out what I thought I needed to believe in order to be a Mormon. And I kept defining it over time. What now do I think I believe to be? Do I need to believe to be a Mormon? But in 1978, I started exploring my religious dilemmas more publicly. The impetus was a paper I presented for the Society for Values in Higher Education. I call it Struggling with the Paradoxes of Mormon Tradition. I argued that my feminist ideology, my humanistic orientation, and other sources of conflict that I had with the church could be interpreted as having a basis in Mormon culture and history, as well as in my personal Mormon background and experience and values. And I suggested that mining this Mormon milieu to find justification for my heretical views was something that other Mormons were doing too, and I had examples of that. And similar to what actually Joseph Smith did, as he found justification in the Judeo and Christian traditions for his heresies. I expanded on this paper in an article and dialogue called Living with Opposition in All Things. And I think there's a theme that's starting to develop here. I concluded in this article, however, that I was incorrigibly Mormon, and I would simply choose to live with the contradictions inherent in trying to resolve the paradoxes of Mormon life. And at the same time, I was trying to keep a very low profile in my Indiana work. I avoided any discussion that would lead to confrontation or conflict. However, I did give a presentation at the local Unitarian Universalist congregation on the paradox of being a Mormon feminist, and there was a discussion in the high priest quorum asking whether I had asked for and been given permission to do that. But I found this out secondhand. They never confronted me. It was duly noted through the grapevine that I had been seen working with the followers of Satan at the International Women's Year meeting, but again, they didn't confront me about it. I was staying mostly below the radar. And then in 1981, I connected with the Sunstone community, and it was wonderful. I began presenting papers at the symposia, writing reviews and articles, and I did a column called Paradoxes and Perplexities. It was a very productive period. I loved it. I found that the process of writing these columns particularly helped me focus and analyze my dilemmas. Although sometimes I would write a Mormon version of an article or paper that I was working on academically. And it became clear in this process how different my two worlds were. In the Mormon world, I was a liberal heretic. But among my fellow psychologists and sociologists, I was somewhere between the conservative end of the spectrum and the moderate mainstream. I was definitely not a liberal heretic there. And sometimes I'd be confused about where I was supposed to be a liberal heretic and where I was supposed to be conservative. It was kind of confusing that living in two worlds. And that confusion was made worse by some feedback that I would occasionally receive at humanistic psychology meetings. Over the years, several people commented on the spiritual energy that they sensed in me. That caught me off guard because at that point I had defined myself as lacking in spirituality, at least in the Mormon context. So why was this hidden spirituality sneaking out in these secular circles? It's true that I occasionally had paranormal kinds of experiences like ESP and deja vu and the kind of things that would be called faith-promoting if they were in a Mormon context. But for me, they typically happened in a non-Mormon context. And so I preferred to describe them as part of Jung's concept of synchronicity. And I was explaining them with a model that was closer to quantum physics than it was to spirituality. I was also working with Jung's model of psychological type as an explanation for personality differences, and I realized that our personality preferences affect how we experience spirituality and religion. My natural spiritual path of reflective awareness and spontaneous devotion can be religious, but it's not a typical Mormon religiosity, which tends to be more emphasizing activity and service and obedience and discipline, which was not me. Defining my struggles with the Mormon Church in terms of personality preference was very helpful in relieving the angst of my struggle. If there was simply different spiritual paths, I could affirm my path without being overly concerned that it was not a typical Mormon path. I could sort of have an agree-to-disagree détente with the Church, even if it was a completely one-sided, defined only in my mind, agreement to disagree. Occasionally, I would hear stories of the Church cracking down on liberal Mormons in Utah, and I would make comments like, I don't know how long I can stay in this Church, but I didn't say I want to leave the Church. And I really didn't think I would get in trouble because I was out in Indiana under the radar, I thought. My major academic project at the time was a theory of intimacy, which pulled together the work I had done in sexuality and gender issues and the structure and function of marriage and its alternatives. I had collected some data on a polygamous marriage, and my analysis led me to see similarities with other atypical marriage forms, including the Moonies and their marriages, and swingers and group marriages, and all of the kind of 70s exploration that the baby boomers were doing. You baby boomers might remember those 70s, they were interesting times, and also homosexual relationships. And at the time, there was this political movement that was had arisen that was using the term pro-family. I think it still might be around. But actually, it's against anything other than the traditional family. And it occurred to me that if we were truly pro-family, we would want to extend the blessings of marriage to as many people as possible. And thus, we would promote and support all people who want to establish committed relationships based on love. We would evaluate these unions based on the quality of the relationship rather than on its demographics. So I defined what I called a radical pro-family perspective, and I presented it at the 1984 Sunstone Symposium, and then at the Society for the Scientific Study of Sex meeting with an academic focus. I got distinctly different reactions at the two meetings. And that was the paper that Bill heard. I thought the basic premise was quite straightforward and obvious. If we value loving, committed relationships, we should support them, help them be healthy and strong, buy them blenders and toasters. In addition to being beneficial for the individuals involved, such support is good for society because the inherent social control in marriage mitigates the abuses and dysfunctions that occur when we marginalize groups of people. And so I thought it'd be good there. I used both polygamous and gay marriages as examples, so I could say this is just a general principle that fits into my overall academic theory, because I saw it as a theoretical academic paper, not as social and political advocacy at the time. Back then, the social and political advocacy actually hadn't started yet. It was in its infancy. Only among a few academics in sexuality were we really talking about gay marriage. So I didn't expect that the church would immediately start performing gay marriages or polygamous marriages. But I hoped to lay the groundwork for thinking about it in a broader way. And it worked. It only took 25 years. And now we are thinking and talking about it in exactly the terms that I was talking about 25 years ago. And 2 days ago was a glorious day. I guess the most surprising thing is not that I was called to account for this paper, but that I was surprised that I was called to account for it. And I was also surprised that it was the gay stuff that got me. I thought if I was going to get in trouble, it'd be over polygamy. But it was the gay marriage thing that they didn't like. My bishop told me that one of his counselors was in Utah for a wedding and happened to hear my paper and thought it was inappropriate, and the bishop was concerned and wanted me to recant. In retrospective, this story does not completely ring true. I think a more likely scenario is that the word came down from church headquarters that I had been preaching heresy and should be called to repentance. But I didn't question the story at the time because it didn't really matter. And in truth, it still doesn't matter how it happened. Somewhat surprisingly for someone so incorrigible, I did not hesitate at all. I did not struggle with a decision. I pled no contendere and offered to leave quietly and spare everybody the bother of a contested trial. I was in the middle of a divorce at the time, and in truth, I didn't have the emotional energy to make an issue of this issue. I was already stretched pretty thin. So the decision turned out to be easy. I would not recant, I would leave the church, and the process itself was smooth and easy. I was on a panel with on excommunication yesterday and heard how difficult those excommunication trials were, but mine was easy. I wrote a letter, I sent it to them, they held the trial, I didn't attend, they sent a letter back, it was done. I didn't encounter any hostility among board members because I didn't see any board members, and in Indiana it was very easy to avoid. And so it was easy. It didn't feel like a real excommunication in some ways because I had requested it. On the other hand, it didn't feel like merely leaving the church because I did not take the initiative. I was responding to the trial. An astute psychologist might speculate that at some level I was ready to leave the church, but unwilling to take that step on my own, and so I just pushed the envelope to the point where I'd be asked to leave. I remain neutral on that analysis. But what I felt at the time was a great wave of relief. Like a weight had been lifted from me, all the issues and questions and struggles just didn't matter nearly as much anymore. I moved to another town about 30 miles away. I got remarried and started the process of blending families. And in that process, questions about the church kind of faded into the background. The following spring, however, we started dealing with the religious question again. Susan had not been involved with the church since she had moved to Indiana, but she had not resolved her membership question, and it wasn't a given that she would leave the church just because I had. Her issues were slightly different than mine. I always liked Mormon theology. In history. Actually, I loved Mormon theology in history. It was great fun. My issues were with the social politics and with my ability to believe what I wanted to in those areas. Both of us had been orthopractic. Behavioral mandates were not a problem. But from an early age, Susan had gotten into trouble for asking too many questions. She had been bothered by many theological positions that didn't make sense, and every year at Temple Recommend Time, she would study the interview and struggle with whether she could answer yes to the belief questions. And finally, she couldn't. But was that a strong enough motivation to end her membership? She could just stop going to Temple Recommend interviews. More compelling motivation was more definitional. She hated the concept of being inactive. If there's ever a word that did not define her, it would be inactive. That just didn't fit. And she hated being defined as somebody's problem. When she was ending her first marriage, her bishop pleaded with her not to get a divorce because he would have to answer to Christ for having allowed it to happen on his watch. Don't get this divorce because I'll get in trouble. She couldn't abide the thought of having innocent people feel guilty about not being able to get her to do what they wanted her to do. So she wrote her letter and gave up her membership in order not to be a burden in order not to be on somebody's to-do list. Initially, I had been mainly aware of feelings of relief that I did not need to continue juggling my two different worlds. But we now started getting in touch with the loss that was also part of this transition. The primary sadness has been the loss of the strong family connection that is part of sharing membership in the same church. We decided that what we and our families, our parents, our siblings, our children, and now our grandchildren, what we experience is terminal sadness. There is simply no way that they cannot be sad that we do not share the love of the gospel that is so important to them. And there is no way that we cannot be sad that they do not accept our choice as an equally valid one. The bad thing about terminal sadness is that nothing can be done about it. But that's also the good thing about it, because if nothing can be done about it, there's no need to try to do anything about it. You don't need to do anything to change it. And if you don't need to try to change it, you can focus on how to live with it in the best way possible. There's no reason to be angry about it, or depressed about it, or frustrated with it. You simply live with it. It's a given. And so we focused on what we wanted our post-Mormon lives to be like. We were not and did not want to be angry. We were not and did not want to be anti-Mormon. We had no inclination to convince anyone else that they should not belong to the church. We both felt that growing up Mormon was a good way to grow up. We had no agenda to keep our children, to have our children leave the church. All six of our children, blended families, will do that to you, went to and they graduated from BYU, and we supported them. Four of the six went on missions, and we supported them. Even though I meant sending the donation directly to the church, and I worried about triggering a tax audit. Too many churches on this tax return. But three of the four who married at this point did so in the temple. Five of the six are currently involved with the church. Now, this is a better retention rate than our parents had. We sometimes joked that the kids rebelled against us by becoming more committed Mormons. And that's a strategy that some people might want to consider. All eight of our grandchildren are being raised as Mormons. We've never said or done anything to discourage them from church involvement. We were determined to do what we could to keep the religious differences from destroying the relationships with our families. We refused to take offense and tried not to give offense. It took effort, it was not easy, but over time we established workable patterns. There was one time when Susan's oldest son came back from Utah with a serious question. Susan's mother had told him that he would not be worthy to go on a mission if he did not get his back in his church. After assuring him that that was not true, Susan told her mother that if she wanted to have a relationship with us, she needed to play fair. And it was not acceptable to use the kids to fight the fight. We didn't get angry, but we established the boundaries, and over time they became the norms. It wasn't perfect. We were always aware that they did not approve of our religious choice. And I could, if I chose to, tell this story in a way that would emphasize how awful it was. But we chose not to do that. We managed to keep the issue mostly in the background, and we did not have to deal with it on a daily basis. It helped to be in Indiana. We followed the old universalist maxim, we do not need to think alike in order to love alike. The most common religious question that we've been asked by Mormons, by friends and family, is how we manage to live moral lives without the steadying influence of the church. There seems to be a fairly pervasive notion that the only thing that is strong enough to keep people in line is the constraints of the church, and without those we would throw morality to the wind, become wild and debaucherous sinners doing all manner of evil. Susan's mother was particularly perplexed by how we could continue to be so good when we were being so bad. It never made sense to us. All major religions and non-religious ethical systems share a similar ethical code based on some variation of the Golden Rule. This similarity is much more important than which story we happen to believe or happen to have been taught. Why would we throw away our ethical code just because we didn't believe this particular story anymore? It never made sense to us. If anything, we have probably been more moral as non-Mormons than we were as Mormons. We certainly have been more deliberate in thinking through our ethical code, and I think more successful in following it. The real divide, after all, isn't between believers and non-believers. It's between those who want to do good and those who don't really care. And we were always in the former camp. We've actually lived quite staid, some might say boring, lives, not dissimilar from typical Mormon lives in terms of moral values. We have not, of course, felt compelled to attend to the institutional mandates of Mormonism, such as the word of wisdom and tithing and fasting and prayer and Sunday observance and avoiding grown-up movies and that sort of thing. But these are superficial parts of the lifestyle, not moral or ethical questions. On the moral and ethical questions, if there is an afterlife, the best strategy is to live a good and moral life to prepare for the afterlife, to continue that good life. If there is not life after death, the mandate is still to live a good and moral life because this is all there is. And if this is all there is, you better make it the best you can make it. Membership in the church does not change the moral mandate. I have several columns in the pipeline with Sunstone. And this I've continued being published there for a couple of years. I sometimes revise my symposium presentations to use as columns. And decided to do that with the Radical Pro Family paper. Because of space constraints, I cut out the polygamy parts and focused on just the question of supporting gay marriages in a column that I called In Favor of Families. The editors decided that it was too radical and declined to print it. When I had become too extreme for Sunstone, I realized that it was time to move on. A few years later, that column was actually published in a book, in the book Peculiar People, but it didn't make it to the magazine. And I had already moved on. I focused on my work in personality theory. We continued to subscribe to Sunstone and sometimes to donate because we really value the role of Sunstone in the church and in our lives. But more and more I found that I read Sunstone with kind of a mild interest, a curiosity. The best part of that is I don't get exercised by what I read and what the church does. Is. Things that used to just drive me crazy simply don't matter very much anymore. We spent the first year or two in a lazy period, enjoying having the Sabbath truly be a day of rest, observing Sunday out in the sun like it's supposed to be observed. We soon started feeling the desire, however, to be part of a moral community, and we looked for a compatible one. As my premonitions foreshadowed, the obvious choice was the Unitarian Universalist option. Becoming a UU, which is what we call ourselves sometimes, is one of the easiest transitions I ever made. It's a spiritual path that fits me to the T, and it felt so good to define ourselves as Unitarian Universalists rather than as former Mormons. It's been a great moral community for us. I've never been inclined to convert anyone else to it, but there's no question in my mind that it's the right path for me. And the key word is congruence. I don't need to do mental gymnastics to make things fit. So often my reaction to UU sermons are not just, oh, I can accept that, or I agree with that, but, oh, I could have written that. Well, that's the way I would have said it. Indeed, being a Unitarian minister would have been a great alternate career for me. I even looked the part. Unitarian ministers are required to have beards. Well, once I was asked if I'd be willing to shave my beard off to make me a member of the High Council. Oh, so they could make me a member of the High Council. And I declined. I said, I knew that I would need it someday. The original defining characteristic of Unitarian theology was the rejection of the dogma of the Trinity, of the Nicene Creed. But the dominant theme of Unitarianism has always been religious freedom. In the 1500s, several Unitarian heretics were burned at the stake, but the King of Transylvania issued an edict of religious toleration to protect them in his kingdom, and that's widely seen as the beginning of Unitarianism as a religion. The Unitarian perspective had many adherents among the founding fathers in the American Revolutionary War period, although it was not yet really an organized religion. And some people argue that it's still not an organized religion. But there's more that could be said about that. But the Unitarian promotion of religious freedom was again more important than the theological issue, and it was reflected in the Constitution, which was divinely inspired through Unitarians. When we visited our son in Boston, when they lived there, we enjoyed the fact that in almost every surrounding town, Lexington, Concord, all of the good ones, the dominant church on the town square is invariably Unitarian and often looks like the Kirtland Temple. We come out of that same time period. Then there's the universalist tradition. The defining belief was universal salvation. Like the Unitarians, the Universalists were congregational. They didn't have a strong central church structure. Both were strong proponents of social justice, and over the years have been active in the abolitionists, the women's suffrage movement, helping Jews escape from the Nazis in World War II, more recently in the civil rights and gay rights movements. So they had much in common. And after discussing it for 60 years, which is typical, the Unitarians and the Universalists finally merged into the Unitarian Universalist Association in 1961. There's an old joke that describes the differences between the orientations. The Universalists believe that God is too good to damn them, and the Unitarians believe that they're too good to be damned. And I'm kind of a Unitarian. But becoming a UU was not a conversion. There was nothing to convert to. It was simply a process of self-discovery. One of the adult religious education programs is building your own theology. The UUA has no theology, has no creed. It's up to the individual to define his or her own set of beliefs. And some of these can be theological, but they don't need to be. What's important is to define your relationship to the universe, to other people, the world, to yourself. Whether or not that includes a relationship to God is up to you. There's another adult education course on dealing with the haunting church. And I love that phrase, the haunting church. It recognizes that previous religious affiliations continue to have an influence on us. And there are within the church subgroups. There are Christian UUs. There are Jewish UUs. Some people call them Unitarians. There are Buddhist UUs. There are pagan UUs. There are humanistic UUs. And there's an occasional Mormon UU. In 1999, the UUA held their General Assembly in Salt Lake City. The prospect of going to Utah for General Assembly was just too good to pass up. We loved the statement that I made to our families, and we enjoyed being official delegates of our congregation with full voting rights. I mean, it really is a democracy. And it was a great experience. But there was one thing that was disconcerting. Because the Salt Lake UU congregations were hosting the assembly, a couple of the breakup sessions were organized by these congregations and focused on what it's like to be Unitarian in Utah. We were surprised by the pain and anger that was expressed as they described how difficult it was to deal with families and co-workers in society in general. We wanted to present a session where we could say, wait, it doesn't have to be that way, because that was not our experience. I don't know how much of the difference in our experience comes from living in Indiana, where we did not need to deal with Mormon culture on a daily basis, and how much came from our attitude that we would put energy into maintaining good family relations and would not succumb to anger against the church. I really don't know what it would have liked, would have been like if we lived in Utah. I don't know if we could have pulled it off. But in Indiana, while there hasn't been a whole lot of contact with Mormons, what there has always been cordial and often friendly. We've had no negative interaction. The other potential source of conflict came as the children got married, and we had to explain to their spouses why we were not Mormon. and dealt with the possible rejection from the future in-laws. But we approached it without a chip on our shoulders, and we had no problems and no ill will. We were able to establish and maintain good relationships. In fact, we think that we were accepted more easily by these new people in our lives as UUs than we would have been as inactive Mormons. We think it would have been more difficult to hold on to the inactive Mormon part. The temple marriages themselves also had the potential to be sources of pain and conflict. But we chose not to let that happen. When we told non-Mormon friends that we could not attend the wedding ceremony, they would often be indignant or incredulous. But we knew the territory, we knew the rules, we knew that we had chosen to be outside of the fold, and so we chose not to feel excluded or hurt, because that would not have been good for anyone. We hosted the wedding breakfast and all that, and we waited outside the temple with the younger kids and the grandkids until it was time to be in the pictures. We did not make an issue of the ceremony, and we had a wonderful time celebrating the marriages. I must admit, however, that when our daughter Liz decided to have a Unitarian wedding, we were delighted that we would finally be able to fully participate. And we recognized, in retrospect, how much we had missed by missing the previous ceremonies. I'm coming to the hard part now, but I think I can get through it if you'll be patient with me. 6 years ago, Susan was diagnosed with leukemia, and we entered into our battling with cancer phase. And last year at this time, we had opted for palliative care and the transition to hospice. As Susan's death approached, our chosen faith was tested. Would our conviction give us the courage to face death with the same strength that we tried to face life with? A couple of years earlier, we had been involved with helping Susan's parents die, as they were dying. I can say with confidence that although Susan's death was terribly premature by a whole generation, coming only a year after her parents, she was more prepared to face it than her parents had been. She did not worry about what, if anything, death would bring. She was ready for any eventuality. Her only regret was not having more time with those she loved, especially the grandchildren. She spent her waning energy focused on making sure that she had done all that she could for them, particularly the grandchildren. Just as we had discovered that we did not need to be Mormon to live good lives, she proved that you don't have to be Mormon to die with peace and dignity and without fear. She did not pretend to know if there would be an afterlife, but thought it was a simple question. In the end, either you continue to exist or you don't. Either way, Susan felt that she would be able to make the best out of what came her way, as she had done her whole life. She was confident that she could handle whatever death would bring. She believed that if you live in love, you will be in heaven no matter where you are, in this life or the next. If there's a continuation of life after death, she will continue to live in love and continue to be in a state of heaven. If we cease to exist after death, at least she will continue to live in the memories of those who love her. And in line with the way that we had adopted our chosen faith without creating conflicts with our family, we were able to keep religion from being a disruptive force in death. Our minister friend Ed and his wife came out to Utah with me to conduct a Unitarian memorial service with distinctive Mormon overtones in a Mormon stake center. They have to have a stake present in the family. We had Mormon hymns and Unitarian hymns and romantic songs and Mormon memories and Unitarian memories, but no theological debates. We didn't have the plan of salvation sermon that you're supposed to have. We were able to truly honor her life in a way that acknowledged both traditions without pitting them against each other. And then we repeated a similar beautiful memorial service at All Souls Unitarian Church in Indianapolis. She proved in death, as she had in life, that religious differences do not need to get in the way of family love. That was the hard part. So here I am, 26 years post-Mormon. What's my assessment? There is no question in my mind that leaving the Mormon Church and becoming a Unitarian Universalist was the right thing for me to do. It allowed me to live a happier and more coherent life. The UU world is a good match for me. It fits my personality. It's intellectually and emotionally satisfying. My political and social views are shared and valued. I'm proud to be part of this moral community. It isn't perfect. Some congregations are a better fit for me than others. Its non-coercive mode allows me to exercise my freedom of choice in many ways, but it also allows me to remain less involved than I probably ought to be. Do I think it's a good option for everyone? Not necessarily. This is an intensely personal decision that I would not presume to make for anyone else. And what do I believe? I agree with George Kelly that the universe does not owe allegiance to any person's conception of it. I could come up with interesting theories or theologies, but the fact that I like them, or might believe them, or even might think that I know them, would not cause the universe to conform to them. The truth is, even that universal remote control does not control the universe. And the universe feels no allegiance to our constructs. 30 years ago, I said that my core belief was in the concept of eternalism, as taught by Joseph Smith and elucidated by Truman Manson. This idea still has some appeal to me, but I'm unable to come up with an operational definition or a description of the logistics of eternalism that completely rings true to me. And I can't find one that's logically consistent, intuitively satisfying. I have tried with limited success to interpret it in terms of quantum physics that fits well with Jungian synchronicity and with humanistic spirituality. But here again, the model is not completely satisfying because I cannot really comprehend how it would play out, what it would be like. Susan and I decided that if we believed in anything, it would be in energy, because we had felt the force of energy in our lives, probably akin to feeling the spirit. But I have no theological or theoretical explanation for what this energy is, how it works, what it means to believe that this energy might be eternal. Because in truth, I don't understand quantum physics. I use it, but I don't understand it. I'm not sure that anybody does. And so where I end up with is uncertainty. As C.S. Lewis observed his grief, he recognized that I or any mortal at any time might be utterly mistaken as to the situation that we are really in. Or as Sheldon Kopp puts it, all important decisions must be made on the basis of insufficient data. And yet, we are responsible for everything that we do. I am comfortable with uncertainty. I have learned that it's good to eat dessert first. I find that I prefer ambiguity over ambivalence. I value congruence and try to approach that ideal. I've learned that it's possible to live with uncertainty and to die with it and to be okay with it. I can truly say that the past 26 years have been the best years of my life. Oh no, that sounds suspiciously like a testimony, doesn't it? Sorry about that. Scratch that. They have been good years. I do not, however, disvalue my previous Mormon life. I still have fond memories of my childhood, my adolescence, my mission, my early adulthood of exploration, those great sunstone years. I love them. I feel no need to denigrate Mormonism in order to feel good about Unitarianism. I sometimes feel sad when I hear about things that the church does, but I don't get angry. I view Mormonism with a kind of bemused but affectionate detachment. It saddens me to hear people attack the church, especially some of the unjustified or exaggerated attacks. I find myself feeling somewhat protective, almost defensive. I even felt protective about Mitt Romney. And that is really weird. I do not like the anti-Mormon websites that have proliferated. I've never considered myself to be anti-Mormon, have no need to invalidate the belief and commitment that other people feel for the church and the satisfaction that they experience from their involvement in it. I have found a better fit for me. But it's simply my personal story. It's not a critique of Mormonism or of the Mormon Church. In the midst of the somewhat turbulent graduate school years, when I was beginning to try figuring out where this religious struggle was leading me, I wrote a poem in which I identified with the ocean. I noted that at one level, the ocean is in constant motion, continually changing, sometimes turbulently so. But at a higher level of abstraction, this constant change was actually a constant. It was a consistent pattern that would always be there. And so it was with me. I concluded, there's comfort to be found in this. In growth and change, I find not someone new or strange to be, but more of what I've always been. My pattern stays the same. This reflective old Unitarian has a lot in common with the good little Mormon boy, the adolescent spiritual giant, the slightly rebellious missionary, the questioning young adult, and the occasionally outrageous Sunstone columnist. I recognize them all. My pattern stays the same.
Thank you, Marvin. Very moving, and I do think that your way you and Susan face death is very mature faith, which is a theme at this conference. We have about 7 minutes left. Get in line. Don't wait for the guy to finish. Just get in line behind and start up.
Okay. I was very touched by your story, which I resonate to, because I followed the path when Mormon to Unitarian too, but I wasn't born in Utah. I was born in New York. And as to the question of Unitarians feeling like they hate being Unitarians in Utah, it's so hard. I'm a member of the South Valley Unitarian Universalist, and I have never heard anybody say that there. And so I have heard it from people who had problems with the Mormon Church, and they disagreed with the theology, and they have just made discoveries in history that is uncomfortable for them. There's a lot of Mormons come through the Unitarian Church looking for something else. Mm-hmm. And I run a leader transition group that is based on the religious freedom and the right to feel as you feel and think as you think, and where we can have honest discussion. And the anger, I think, my interpretation of the anger, those in transition feel, is because they were never allowed to speak openly about their doubts and their beliefs totally. So the biggest issue for those people is a conflict with the mates or the parents or the families. It's hard to cope with, and what's needed is honest discussion and willingness to accord respect to all sides. So that's what I think. Do you have any comment?
I'm glad to know that one session that we attended was not universally shared. And I suspected that it wasn't. But it just drew to our attention the fact that we had it pretty easy, comparatively. And I agree that the important thing is just to have respect on all sides.
Yeah. All people don't have it so easy as you. The transition is hard for most people.
Do you, I don't know how to phrase this, you alluded to a pattern. Personally, do you think that it's a genetic pattern, as I said real early? And when did you think you had a pattern that was like this?
You know, as a psychologist, I've been dealing with that kind of question for 40 years now, and I have no idea. But the message is, I do not feel like I'm a different person now that I'm a Unitarian than I was as a Mormon. I don't think it made me a different person. What we happen to believe, the story we happen to believe, should not be that big of an issue. Because we're not different. We simply believe a different story. And we don't have to believe alike. And so that was the message, is that it really does not make that much difference in what kind of a person we are. It doesn't have to.
We've got about 3 minutes. Good chance to make a comment or ask a question. I trust, Marvin, that you didn't feel guilty in Salt Lake City for the UU convention. You didn't feel guilty that you guys didn't go door to door while you were here, like the Baptists did.
I think the Unitarians really loved being in Salt Lake because they came back last year. And we wanted to come back last year, but...
Oh, I just have a quick question. I think the dilemma a lot of people would face is the whole restoration. Was Joseph Smith a prophet? And did the church just change over the years to where you couldn't really feel like you could have your other social behavioral beliefs? So that's my question. Just how you dealt with that part of it. To me, that's the biggest piece.
Yes. The way I dealt with that, just that question of was Joseph a prophet and has the church changed, was just to decide that it didn't really matter to me in the final analysis. I really think what matters is what kind of a life we live, what kind of people we are. And once you've decided that you can be outside of the Mormon Church, that question of the historicity of it, all those questions just don't matter anymore because... You know, you're out, you're not in. And it doesn't matter. Yesterday at the excommunication panel, I explained a notion that I had come up with about 2 or 3 years. It was in one of my Sunstone papers a couple years before the 84 one, where I decided that all relationships are eternal because we are eternal. And then I explained it in more detail. And I really had come to the conclusion that it really didn't matter whether we had all the ordinances or all of the things, that we would be, if there is a life after, we will be judged on simply who we are. And I gave a phrase from a poem that Robert K. Thomas gave it my missionary farewell. The poem's called Talk, and it's about a boy who watches a shipbuilder build boats, but the shipbuilder is deaf, so he just learns what he sees, and what he learns is, finally, your boat has got to float. You can't explain to the ocean. And that became my view. Your boat has to float. But if your boat floats, that's all that's needed. And so the focus isn't, you know, have you check all the things off the list? The question is, does your boat float? And that's how I deal with it. And at that point, I think it doesn't matter whether you're a Mormon or not. I think it matters whether your boat floats, whether you live a good life.
Okay, this is really a great session. Now Marvin, I used to hear that Unitarians believe in the fatherhood of God and the brotherhood of man is kind of the essential Unitarian belief, and I suppose that's true. But anyway, the seminary heard that since Unitarian Universalist Association formed in 1825, there was something like 140 churches, but about 100 of them were within like 50 miles of Boston, which led somebody to quit. Unitarians believe in the fatherhood of God, the Brotherhood of Man and the Neighborhood of Boston. You can branch out much better since then. My brother was a new Unitarian in Oregon, so I guess it's branched out quite much.
It's still very dominant in Boston.
Okay. Thanks very much.
But we are everywhere, including you.
Thanks for coming. Yeah.
Thank you.